When you think of a serial killer, who comes to mind? Who are the people that leave our landscape littered with battered and mangled bodies? What does your mind conjure up when you think about what the typical serial killer is like? Is it a cunning white man? A man between 25 and 30 years of age? In the case of Ted Bundy, a white straight man. Or in the case of John Wayne Gacy, a gay white man. Is it men who boast having above average intellect? Men who are seen as master manipulators. Men who personify evil. This is a stereotype of the serial killer, but it is not accurate. Women are just as likely to be deadly serial killers, as are blacks, as are Hispanics. Most are not smart at all. And quite often, it's not the lone serial killer. It's families who team up for serial murder. It's couples who team up for serial murder. It's buddies, men or women, who team up for serial murder. It's people who find others who share their perverted joy of killing their fellow humans. In fact, a pair working together introduces a much more complex psychology. A complexity derived from the relationship with each other, as well as their choice of victims. Even so, it is a complexity that mirrors the same needs of the single serial killer. A need for control and dominance over their victims.
It's called a folie à deux, it's French. And it means, I think it means something like two people with the same mindset, the same folly, okay, a folly for two. And I think it's, they kind of have what one of the former FBI agents said is murdar. You know, you have radar and et cetera. It's a murdar. They can get with a person and all of a sudden those antennas go up and it's like, this person's like me. And you got Lakening, you got Lucas and O'Toole. You got Deborah Brown and Alton Coleman. You know, it's what's the attraction? Excitement, adventure, same mindset.
With those type of situations, you have somebody usually that's dominant and somebody that's a little bit more submissive in the pairing, and the one that's dominant decides what they're going to do and who they're going to do and all that, and the submissive one basically does whatever the dominant one tells him to do.
These teams of murderers form a unique breed of monsters in the annals of serial killing. Perhaps the most famous example of folie à deux are Charles Ng and Leonard Lake, a psychopathic duo that personified evil. Ng and Lake together arguably became the most sadistic serial killers that ever walked the earth.
Lake and Ng, they were the ones in the mountains in Calaveras County in California. They were survivalists. They had camouflage and weapons. They built the torture bunker that had a one-way mirror, and they, you know, videotaped their victims. But then they would hunt. They killed some people up in the mountains of Calaveras County. They killed their neighbors, the whole family. Or they would go to San Francisco and stalk the streets and kidnap individuals and bring them out to their place and torture them and kill them. Leonard Lake had what he called a manifesto. It was Operation Miranda. And Miranda was the name of the victim in the book The Collector by Fowles. The Collector kidnapped this woman and kept her. So Lake had Operation Miranda named after her, and he had all the rules that the women had to follow, okay? You know, you will have sex with us when we order, you will cook for us, you will clean for us, etc. If you don't, we'll kill you. Well, they killed him anyway. But it was really a strange place. I went there. And a friend of mine was a deputy in the neighboring county. So we go there and we meet a deputy there and to take us up into the where the place is. And he said, well, you better put some guns on. I have some in the trunk here. We don't know who's up here. There's pot growers and survivalists and that. So we start walking up this dirt path toward the torture bunker, and all of a sudden, it was so evil. I broke into this hot sweat. And I said to my partner, Randy, is it always this hot here? No, it's not like this usually. So, you know, do I believe in an evil spirit? No, but it was just so bizarre that walking up, I'm just sopping wet. So we get up there, and there's all the trenches that they had buried the people in. And they didn't identify a lot of them. All they could do was get bone fragments because they burnt some of them too. And then there was the torture bunker that the sheriff had started tearing down because he didn't want it to be a tourist attraction. But it was a large stone building, looked like a bunker. And there was a one room in there where they put the victims and chained them to the bed or whatever it happened to be. And there was another room that had the mirror and the camera that they could go in and watch and see what was happening.
To fund their torture bunker, Lake killed his own brother, Donald, stealing his identity and available assets. While some victims were killed quickly, others endured days of torture and sexual abuse before granted the sweet release of death. And all of it caught on videotapes recovered at their bunker. Lake, born on October 29, 1945 in San Francisco, California, was abandoned by his mother when a child. He turned his anger into a pathological hatred of women. Ng was born on December 24th in Hong Kong. As a teenager, Ng was described as a troubled loner and was expelled from several schools. Both men were disgraced Marines. Ng desperately sought a father figure, and he found it in Lake. A healthy pattern, except when it leads to rape, torture, and murder. The two men met via correspondence through a survivalist magazine and eventually met each other in person. Immediately, there was a spark of evil that bound them together. In 1984, Ng and Lake began kidnapping and murdering their victims. A lifelong fan of deviant pornography, Leonard Lake enjoyed videotaping the victims that he and Ng had abducted as they assaulted and tortured them. On one tape, an unemotional Ng calmly told his distressed victim, "You can cry like the rest of them, but it won't do you any good. We're pretty cold-hearted." In at least two instances, Ng and Lake kidnapped families of three, each with infant sons. Though the men and children were killed quickly, the women were kept alive for days or weeks on end, sometimes being coerced to participate in sexual acts under the false pretense of seeing their families again.
Lake committed suicide because he was captured in a parking lot in San Francisco when Ng went in and stole a vice, and Ng got away, but they said he came from that car, and the police opened the trunk and there was a handgun with a silencer. So they brought him to the station, Lake, and he had a cyanide tablet secreted in his collar. He took it, bit down on it, wrote a note to his wife, and died. They got Ng a number of years later in Canada. He was caught shoplifting there, and the Mounties got him. And usually Canada Supreme Court does not extradite people to a state that has capital punishment. Well, California has capital punishment. Ng's on death row. And Canada extradited him. And I believe the argument finally was, you know, do you want to be a haven? For every violent criminal comes to Canada to leave America, and you're not going to extradite him because you don't believe in the death penalty. So you're going to fill up with these violent creatures. And I think Canada finally said, you know what, you're right. We'll send Ng back. So they sent Ng back. His trial was one of the longest in his California history. He was in a cage in the courtroom, and he would delay tactics constantly. The food they're giving me in jail is the lettuce is soggy, and the judge would have to talk. And my glasses aren't exactly the right prescription. Finally, you know, enough's enough. Let's move on with this trial. And he's on death row.
Lake and Ng are known to have killed at least 11 people, though most experts estimate that the total is closer to 35. Interestingly, one of the first documented cases of teaming up for murder was not perpetrated by a duo, but was a family affair. A family affair that had their own horror building of death. Kate Bender, another of these early female serial killers, was part of a family team of murderers. They were Pa, Ma, John Jr., and Kate, an American family that earned the nickname the Bloody Benders. In October 1870, five families of German spiritualists settled in western Kansas along the Osage Trail. One of them was the John Bender family, who claimed 160 acres. Pa Bender was described as illiterate and spoke very little English. Ma Bender was born Almira Hill in the Adirondack Mountains. By the time she moved to Kansas, she was believed to have murdered several of her husbands. Kate, the beautiful throat-cutter Bender, was believed to be Ma's fifth daughter. In 1871, a year after arriving in Kansas, the serial killing began. The family had built a one-room home, equipped with a canvas curtain that divided the space into two areas. The front was a public inn and store, and the family quarters were in the back. Travelers on the trail were welcome to refresh themselves with a meal and resupply their wagons.
There have been numerous TV shows and movies about inns where people checked in and don't check out. And this was maybe the archetypal one, the beginning one. In 1871 in Kansas, the Bender family had a little plot of land where they put up a two-room building. One room was their living quarters, the other was the inn. But it wasn't a typical inn because they just killed people. It was a family affair. Pa Bender and John Jr. Bender would keep watch. They would do surveillance over the environment and the flat plains, so it was easy to see folks coming from a long way away. And then when somebody was spotted, they sent Kate out to attract them because most travelers were men and Kate was rather comely. So Kate would go out and lure the men into the house. At that point, Ma took over, Ma Bender, and cooked meals, asked what they would like, and kind of mothered them a little bit. Then, when the meal began, Kate would distract the men in typical ways that women can distract men. And then Pa Bender and John Jr. were behind a curtain that separated the building. And then they were hit with a sledgehammer from behind and then had their throat slit. And there was a trap door in the back part of the house. So the men were killed, their clothes were taken, their items were taken, the bodies were dumped down inside the trap door.
The Benders' luck ran out in March 1873 after a well-known physician from Independence, Kansas named Dr. William York seemingly disappeared after getting off a nearby train. Dr. York had two powerful brothers who were determined to find out what happened to him. The locals decided to search all the residences, and when they came to the Benders' place, it was empty, and the Bloody Bender family was gone. What they found were bodies under the trap door. One local source alleged 8 bodies were located, while another study discovered 10 victims. Estimates of the number of victims ranged as high as 21. Whatever the number, the discovery was a sensation. Soon after, the original death hotel, the Bender Hotel, was wiped from the face of the earth by local residents. As for the Bloody Benders, they disappeared into the winds of time. Although not a real family, The Charles Manson family was one of the more psychologically interesting cases of a group of people teaming up for serial murder. No one personified the dark side of the 60s clash of values more than the sex and drug-crazed demon hippie Charles Manson. He added a new element to the overall violence of the period and opened the floodgates to a new wave of serial killing. Manson's perversion of life included an apocalyptic race war he named Helter Skelter after the Beatles' hit song by the same name. The race war never materialized. Instead, the demented Manson and his equally demented family launched America onto the path of a serial killing spree that would last for decades.
Well, Manson certainly got people interested in crime and homicide. They got interested because of the semi-celebrities that were killed. I say semi because they weren't that well known yet. I think they were on their way to becoming well known. And the way the media treated some of the crime scenes that the sheriff's department allowed them to. The media basically walked all over the law enforcement community during part of that case, and they got a lot of information they shouldn't have had. And a lot of that information came out in the press and in television. Consequently, it just generated more interest on the part of the public. And it's almost as if that was the start of an era of serial killers as well as mass killing done all at one time.
Manson was born in 1934 to a 16-year-old unwed mother, Kathleen Maddox. Named Charles Miles Maddox, he took the name of Manson from a man his mother later married. From the start, Manson's life was a litany of brutality. At age 5, his mother, an alcoholic, sold him to a woman for a pitcher of beer. As a young boy, Manson turned to crime and was in and out of juvenile centers, even escaping from Boys Town in Nebraska. By 1967, when he began to form his infamous family, he had spent half of his 32 years in jails and prisons. 1967 was the summer of love. And Manson set himself up as a self-styled guru in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury, America's center of the counterculture. He attracted followers, mostly women. Together, his family traveled the western U.S. in a hippie-styled VW van, ending up in Los Angeles. Manson controlled his family, loving the sense of power over other human beings. On August 8, 1969, that sense of power turned deadly with the brutal assault at actress Sharon Tate's home. Manson sent members of his family to kill everyone at the house. The victims, Tate, 8.5 months pregnant, her friend Jay Sebring, Abigail Folger, heiress to the Folger coffee fortune, and her lover, were butchered, slashed and stabbed as many as 51 times. When the Manson family members left, they wrote the word pig on the front door in Sharon Tate's blood. 2 nights later, the family struck again. This time, led by Manson, they entered the home of Leno LaBianca and his wife, Rosemary. While Manson watched, The family members used knives to hack their helpless victims to death. The word war was carved into Leno LaBianca's stomach, while the couple's blood was used to write the words rise, death to pigs, and helter skelter on the walls of their home. When the Manson family was finally brought to justice, their horrific acts defied understanding. Yet, at the same time, they fascinated the public. And the cause of the killings was hotly debated. Some felt it was a political statement. Others do not agree.
I'm not sure the degree to which I buy into how much Charles Manson really believed in Helter Skelter and the creation of a race war. For example, if you're going to create a race war by killing white people, don't you write things on the walls like, you know, die white motherfuckers or something like that? And they did not do that. These were people who death became part of their day-to-day vibe. Charles Manson liked creating an atmosphere of fear and of that kind of consciousness that fear brings. And certainly the killing of people and killing of the people that they disagreed with, you know, the pigs, so to speak, became common talk around their family and around their group until it became actualized.
After numerous attempts at parole, Charles Manson died in prison on November 19, 2017, from cardiac arrest, respiratory failure, and colon cancer. At the same time as the Manson murders, the cases of real related serial killers became more common and individually unique. Two of the most evil and prolific buddy killers were Angelo Buono and Kenneth Bianchi, also known as the Hillside Stranglers. They were cousins and fit the first of criminologist Dr. Jack Levin's reasons for how killing teams come together.
When people think of serial killers, they think of loners. Well, nothing could be farther from the truth there. Lots of them have relationships with a spouse or a partner. They live with their wives and children. Many of them hold a full-time job, have lots of friends. But about 25 to 30% of all serial killers actually murder in teams. They kill with a partner, with a cousin, a good friend, a lover. They kill together because there's some kind of chemistry that they don't have when they're alone.
Kenneth Bianchi was born in 1951 in Connecticut to an alcoholic mother. After dropping out of college, he became a security guard and supported himself with petty thefts of businesses and homes he was supposed to protect. He drifted to stay out of the clutches of the law and only settled down in 1977 when he finally arrived in Los Angeles and began hanging out with his cousin, Angelo Buono. Buono was older by 17 years. In trouble with the law from an early age, he was now a pimp, wore fancy clothes, jewelry, and impressed Bianchi with tales of getting as many women as he wanted and putting them in their place. Bianchi joined his cousin as a pimp. Very quickly, the pair turned to murder. The older Buono was the mastermind.
There's a number of cases of a serial murder that involve more than one individual who participated. And the Hillside Stranglers are a classic example of two men whose aberrations dovetailed nicely and allowed them to pursue their common interest in killing and, well, in raping and killing these women. One was a dominant character. I think that's, again, pretty typical of these pairings of serial killers. Buono was a dominant personality. He was the one who really gave the orders. He was the one who really, he was the one who said, this is the night or this isn't the night, this is the time, this isn't the time.
Posing as police officers from 1977 to 1978, the pair targeted Los Angeles, easily hunting down victims. Indeed, the Hillside Strangler's MO has become a staple of television, replayed in shows such as Numbers and the CSI franchise. They used this MO to target women. Their first, on October 18th, was a Hollywood prostitute known as Yolanda Washington. They killed roughly once a week after that, dumping their victims' lifeless bodies on hillsides around Los Angeles. Hence the name, the Hillside Stranglers. Eerily, one night, their trail of death took a macabre twist. Dressed in their trademark MO as police officers, they approached a young woman and asked for her ID. Her driver's license read Catherine Laurie, and next to it was a picture of her as a child sitting on the knee of actor Peter Laurie, her father. Ironically, Laurie had starred as the serial killer of children in the riveting movie M. The pair, not wanting to draw attention to themselves, left the daughter alone and moved on to another target. In addition to the Hillside Strangler's signature of death by strangulation, using a ligature, the two men tortured their victims, making them the most depraved of all the buddy serial killers.
They committed some really heinous acts, like injecting people with boric acid, doing transfusions on people, and then trying to stuff all kinds of cleaning chemicals besides boric acid into their system, putting a bag over their head and putting a vacuum cleaner on the bag, basically suffocating the victim. I mean, these are pretty horrific ways for people to die. So they came up with some doozies.
In 4 months, they killed at least 10 women and perhaps scores more. But no one in law enforcement could figure out who they were or where they would strike next. The killers were too mobile, and Buono, the mastermind, was too smart. Then it all changed. Angelo Buono gave up killing, and bizarrely, this would lead to his capture and the undoing of the perverted buddy system. Without his cousin's leadership, Bianchi was lost.
Bianchi, on the other hand, left L.A. and goes up to state of Washington and works as a security guard and winds up killing two people and leaves a very, the whole killing was very amateurish, and he was discovered very rapidly. He had access to the home where the victims had obviously been killed, even though they'd been stuffed in a car and dropped in a ravine. Later, they got information on them, they had witnesses. So he was easily caught.
Sentenced to death in the state of Washington, Bianchi turned on his cousin in order to save his own life. Buono was tried in California and found guilty. The presiding judge, Ronald M. George, declared at the end of the trial that he would have imposed the death penalty without a second thought for Buono's heinous acts if the jury had allowed it. Buono got life in prison. And Calipatria State Prison is where he died of a heart attack in 2002. Bianchi is currently serving a life sentence at the Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla. Criminologist Jack Levin has met with Kenneth Bianchi. Their interaction was a startling glimpse into the mind of a serial killer.
I interviewed Ken Bianchi, one of the Hillside Stranglers, a man who had killed 12 women and girls in Los Angeles and also Bellingham, Washington. When we met, he shook my hand in an appropriate way, you'd think, but he gripped it so tightly that I really thought I was going to scream. And I was thinking about that very hard handshake, and I was thinking, look, there are lots of people in this world who have a very hard handshake, and they're very nice people. But knowing that Ken Bianchi had killed 12 women, knowing how much he craved power and control, suggested to me that that grip that he had on my hand was meant to send me a message. Look, pal, you may have your PhD and all that, but as long as you're here with me behind bars, I'm still in charge of things, and don't you forget it.
It's interesting that apparently the parent-child serial killing team is a fairly rare phenomenon. One notable exception is the case of Sante Kimes and her son, Kenneth Kimes Jr., Kenny. Sante Kimes was born in 1934 in Oklahoma City and soon became a self-trained con artist. Following a brief marriage to Lee Powers, she married her second husband, Kenneth Kimes. Born in 1975, they had a son, Kenny. Throughout his childhood, Kenny's mother continued as a petty thief and was eventually arrested for dealing in the human slave trade. After her release from prison, they teamed up, and the two became grifters, accomplished at swindling. The con game turned to murder when Sante forged an old friend, David Kasdan's signature on a loan application using his house as collateral. When Kasdan found the forgery, he threatened to expose Sante. However, Sante had her 23-year-old son Kenny kill Kasdan by shooting him in the back of the head. Kasdan's body was found in a dumpster near Los Angeles Airport in March 1998. Later that year, she and her son conned their way into the good graces of Irene Silverman, a wealthy Fifth Avenue widow in New York City. They got her to sign over her property and then killed her. Later, Kenny confessed that after his mother used a stun gun on Silverman, he strangled her and stuffed her corpse into a bag. He then deposited the body in a dumpster in Hoboken, New Jersey. Kenny also confessed to murdering a third man, banker Saeed Balal Ahmed, at his mother's behest in the Bahamas in 1996. Kenny testified that the two acted together to drug Ahmed, drown him in a bathtub, and dump his body offshore, but no charges were ever filed in that case. The mother-son serial team was apprehended in New York City shortly after the Silverman murder. Interestingly, evidence recovered from their car at the time of their arrest helped establish the case for the Kasdan murder as well. Never in the annals of crime has a beautiful, wealthy woman masterminded the breathtaking range of criminal activity, arson, to sophisticated financial fraud, to multiple cold-blooded murders. Pictured here at her trial, a Justice Department prosecutor said, "Sante is really scary." "Sante is a monster," said a Kimes family member. "She is not afraid of anyone, not afraid of anything. Kenny Kimes, this relative says, has a duplicate mind of hers. He doesn't know right from wrong. She warped him. Like mother, like son, when it came to murder. Sante Kimes died of natural causes on May 19, 2014, at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility for Women. Her son, Kenny, awaits possible release from prison. Most male serial killers who had families, including Dennis Rader, a.k.a. BTK, John Wayne Gacy, the Clown Killer, and Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer, kept their evil deeds well hidden from their wife and children. One man who didn't was Joseph Callinger. Callinger was born on December 11, 1936, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. In December 1937, abandoned by his parents, young Joseph was placed in a foster home. As a child, Callinger rebelled against his teachers and his abusing foster parents. Callinger married twice, had six children, was in and out of mental hospitals, committed petty crimes including arson and child abuse. By mid-1974, he was constantly hearing voices from a floating head that followed him around. God also spoke to him and told him to kill young boys and sever their penises. Eager to comply, Joe enlisted his 13-year-old son, Michael, and proceeded to torture and murder a 9-year-old Puerto Rican youth. Their next victim was one of his own children, Joe Jr., who had previously accused him of abuse. For such a transgression, the hapless youngster was found drowned in an abandoned building. Posing as a salesman on January 8, 1975, Callinger and his son gained entrance to a house in Leonia, New Jersey. For the next several hours, they beat, robbed, and terrorized the eight people inside. One of the eight, a 21-year-old nurse named Maria Fasching, was taken to the basement, tied up, sexually assaulted, and then killed. Of low IQ, Callinger got careless during the getaway, discarding a bloody shirt near the scene. Officers traced the shirt to Callinger, and the father-son duo were arrested on January 17th by a joint raiding party of federal and state authorities. Michael, the son, was deemed salvageable. He was placed on probation until his 25th birthday. After the probation ended in 1982, he changed his name and started a new life for himself. Joseph Callinger died in prison from a seizure in 1996. The end didn't come soon enough for this sadistic, insane serial killer. However, most murderers who team up to kill are not relatives. Instead, in a warped way, some are lovers. Lovers who find shared joy in torturing and killing another human being. This joy of killing, together, has no ethnic, nor racial, nor gender boundaries. Women are just as likely to team up for murder as their male counterparts.
We've certainly had females who are more aggressive than some male serial killers. There isn't a way to say there's a female type of serial killer because some kill for gain. Quite often they kill for gain. They kill their husbands, for insurance or whatever the husband has. They might kill their children because the children are a burden or they're looking for attention or they have a mental illness. Quite often you're going to find something like Munchausen syndrome by proxy in that group, or borderline personality disorder, something like that. But we still do have predatory females who are looking for personal gain. They don't tend to kill for reasons of lust, but some have. I've actually seen statements where there's no such thing as a female lust murderer, and that's just not true.
There was the case of Gail Graham and Catherine May Wood.
There were two who worked together in an elder care facility in Michigan, and they would together kill patients and then as part of their sex games, and then wash down the bodies and have sex in a vacant room.
The two women met at the Alpine Manor nursing home shortly after Graham had moved to Michigan from Texas. They quickly became friends, and then lovers, in 1986. 2 years later, they both were facing murder charges for allegedly smothering five elderly patients as part of a love bond. Wood claimed Graham murdered the patient to relieve her tension. Wood was described as the psychopathic manipulator, and Graham as a susceptible woman with a personality disorder. Graham is serving a life sentence, and Wood was given early release from prison. Perhaps the best-known female serial killer is Eileen Wuornos. She was the first recognized female serial killer who killed in as violent and abusive manner as any man. What's not so well known is that she had a female partner who participated in her evil deeds, Tyria Ty Moore.
Women are just a strange breed of killer. Many women serial killers are either healthcare professionals, okay, nurses that kill patients, or they are black widows that kill husbands and multiple husbands for insurance money, etc. Serial killer women are rare breed. One of them that stands out is Eileen Wuornos. She killed all of her Johns, people that tried to pick her up and then sexually assault her, as she said. She shot them, killed them all outside, generally speaking. So there's no signature with her. So like I said, many serial killers, males, have a signature. The women, I'm not sure I'd go there.
Once again, here was a serial killer who broke psychologists and law enforcement's common understanding as to what a killer was. This time, it was a gay woman prostitute who killed straight men in 1989 and 1990. The 2003 Hollywood blockbuster film, Monster, starring Charlize Theron as Eileen Wuornos and Christina Ricci as her lesbian lover, romanticizes Wuornos' plight, making her into an anti-hero. Perhaps Eileen's first murder was self-defense. But the next six murders were calculated, cold-blooded killings. Men shot multiple times, their bodies dumped along Florida's highways. Wuornos declared, "I killed those men, robbed them as cold as ice, and I'd do it again, too. I'm competent, sane, and I'm trying to tell the truth. I'm one who seriously hates human life and would kill again." She was born in Rochester, Minnesota on February 28, 1956. Eileen had a rough early life. Her parents separated before she was born. 4 years later, she was abandoned by her mother and adopted by Lori and Britta Wuornos. Despite her traumatic childhood, Eileen showed a talent for singing and dancing, and she expressed interest in becoming a movie star. Childhood photographs show Wuornos was a beautiful, blonde-haired, freckled little girl with a beaming smile. But life took a dark turn when she became pregnant at 14 after being raped. As a young adult, she was uneducated and lacked skills or any kind of job training. The only job she ever had was turning tricks. She frequently stole from the men she serviced. Her prostitution career lasted more than 20 years. After an unsuccessful heterosexual relationship, Wuornos embarked on a lesbian lifestyle. In June 1986, Eileen met Tyria Ty Moore. Now living in Florida, they spent 4 years together and may have partnered in some of the killings. When Warnos started killing at the age of 33, her MO seemed opportunistic in nature. Warnos may have lured the men to their death with the promise of a sexual encounter, or they may have picked her up hitchhiking. She probably lashed out against her victims in anger. Her known victims include Eugene or Troy Burris, Richard Mallory, Walter or Gino Antonio, Charles or Richard Humphreys, Peter Seams, Charles Carskaden, and David Spears. The end to her murderous killing spree was near when, on July 4, 1990, Moore and Warnos were seen abandoning Spears' car. In addition, Warnos's palm print was found on the interior door handle. Police sketches of the suspects were released on November 30, 1990. The sketch depicted a stocky woman wearing a hat and a younger, slimmer woman with tattoos. Warnos was named a suspect several weeks prior to her arrest, and she was put under surveillance. Aileen Warnos was arrested at the Last Resort Bar. Moore was located at the home of her family in Pennsylvania, and she agreed to cooperate with law enforcement in the case against Warnos. Eventually, Warnos confessed to some of the murders and was executed in 2002. Women teamed up in another way for serial murder. Teamed up as traditional loving couples to take the lives of their helpless victims. Except for the bloody benders, the idea that a man and a woman working together could repeatedly murder helpless victims seemed an impossibility. Then came World War II. Serial murder disappeared from the American public scene. However, once the war was over, serial killing emerged as a real psychological and homicidal phenomenon to be studied.
I believe that the actual term serial murder came from a German police officer way back, probably when Hitler was in doing his business in Germany, okay? But it kind of morphed and grew, and then the FBI did their interviews. 36 killers they started with as their pool, and then they decided that serial murder, because movies were serial back in the old days, you had to pay a nickel every week to finish it. Three or more people in separate locations with a sexual component and a cooling off period in between. That's been narrowed down to two or more people. Okay, so they've already notched one down. And there is a movement afoot to have serial killers possibly listed with one victim, because it should be qualitative, not quantitative. It shouldn't necessarily deal on how many victims. It's the killer's mindset, it's the killer's behavior at the crime scene and after the crime scene. So if you kill one person and you get arrested and you go to prison, first of all, you were probably gonna kill a whole lot more, and second of all, you probably had virtually every descriptor for a serial killer. So they're called by some people would-bes, could-bes, wannabes. So yes, the definition has really blossomed over the years and changed.
After the war, with the addition of television to the media world, serial killers became nationally recognized figures. The public wanted to hear all they could about this bizarre, despicable form of human behavior. The reality that a man and a woman team could team up to serial kill came to light with a couple known as the Lonely Hearts Killers, the first of a sequence of buddy male-female serial killers.
You find this kind of circle the wagons mentality where you have a very influential offender and a very impressionable offender. The latter taken under the tutelage of the former, for example. Often somebody who's very needy, who wants or needs a father figure. And you find these two individuals who view the world from the perspective of their own little bubble, and they seem to have convinced each other that they need to kill, that they want people to suffer, and they feed each other's twisted perception and rationalize the murders.
They, Martha and Raymond, also known as the Lonely Hearts Killers, because they met their unsuspecting victims through Lonely Hearts ads. From 1947 to 1951, the year of their executions, they were a media sensation. Martha Beck died at the age of 31, executed in the electric chair at Sing Sing Prison, the same day as her live-in lover, Raymond Fernandez, 36, who was executed a few hours before her. She said, "What does it matter who is to blame?" She continued, "My story is a love story, but only those tortured with love can understand what I mean. I was pictured as a fat, unfeeling woman. I am not unfeeling, stupid, or moronic. In the history of the world, how many crimes have been attributed to love?" Born on May 6, 1920, in Milton, Florida, Martha had a tragic, difficult childhood. She had an overbearing, domineering mother who ridiculed her because of her looks and weight. She was also mercilessly teased and tormented by classmates. Reportedly, she was also sexually molested by her brother at the age of 10. Always plagued by being overweight, after Martha finished school, she studied nursing, moved to California, where she worked in an army hospital as a nurse. She engaged in sexually promiscuous behavior and eventually became pregnant. She tried to convince the father to marry her, but he refused. Single and pregnant, she returned to Florida. Shortly after her daughter was born, she became pregnant again by a Pensacola bus driver named Alfred Beck. They married quickly and divorced 6 months thereafter, and she gave birth to a son. Unemployed and the single mother of two young children, Beck escaped into a fantasy world, buying romance magazines and novels and watching romantic movies. In 1946, she found employment at the Pensacola Hospital for Children. She placed a Lonely Hearts ad in 1947, which Raymond Fernandez answered. Raymond Martinez Fernandez was born on December 17, 1914 in Hawaii to Spanish parents. Shortly thereafter, they moved to Connecticut. As an adult, he moved to Spain, married, and had four children, all of whom he abandoned later on in life. After serving in British intelligence during World War II, Fernandez began a life of petty crime. He once claimed black magic gave him irresistible power and charm over women. Eventually, Fernandez moved to New York City and began answering personal ads by lonely women. He would wine and dine them, then steal their money and possessions. Most were too embarrassed to report the crimes. In one case, he traveled with a woman to Spain, where he visited his wife and introduced the two women. His female traveling companion then died under suspicious circumstances. He then took possession of her property with a forged will. It was probably his first murder. In 1947, he answered a personal ad placed by Martha Beck. Fernandez visited Beck and stayed for a short time. A murderous bond was forming. Martha returned to Florida, but not for long. Shortly, Martha packed up and arrived on Fernandez's doorstep in New York City. He enjoyed the way she catered to his every whim, and when he confessed his criminal enterprises, Martha quickly became a willing participant and abandoned her children in Florida. She posed as Fernandez's sister, giving him an air of respectability. They were constantly writing Lonely Hearts letters with potential candidates they could bilk. Their Lonely Hearts victims often stayed with them or with her. She was extremely jealous and would go to great lengths to make sure he and his intended never consummated their relationship. When he did have sex with a woman, both were subjected to Martha's violent temper. In 1949, the pair committed the three murders of which they would later be convicted. Janet Fay, 66, became engaged to Fernandez and went to stay at his Long Island apartment. When Beck saw her and Fernandez in bed together, she smashed Fay's head in with a hammer in a murderous rage. And then Fernandez strangled her. Fay's family became suspicious, and Martha and Raymond moved on to new victims. They traveled to Byron Center Road in Wyoming Township, Michigan, a suburb of Grand Rapids, to meet Delphine Downing, a young widow with a 2-year-old daughter. While they stayed with Downing, Downing became agitated, and Fernandez gave her sleeping pills. Enraged by Downing's crying daughter, Beck strangled her, though not killing her. Fernandez thought Downing would become suspicious if she saw her bruised daughter, so he shot the unconscious woman. Raymond and Martha stayed for several days in Downing's house. Again, enraged by the daughter's crying, Martha drowned her in a basin of water. They buried the bodies in the basement. But suspicious neighbors reported their disappearance, and police arrived at their door on February 28, 1949. Their story was a media sensation, and eventually Michigan, which had no death penalty, waived their murder convictions, and they were sent to New York, where they could be tried and executed. Two of the worst buddy serial killers were Gerald and Charlene Gallego. From their pictures, they look like the perfect young couple, a perfect young couple who became known as the Love Slave Killers. Born in 1946 in Sacramento, California, Gerald Armand Gallego was bad from birth, and by the time he was 6, he already had a list of sex offenses. Born in the same city, Charlene Adele Williams was a product of a solid, caring home and had an IQ of 160. A 2-time divorcee, she met Gerald, a 7-time divorcee, at a poker club in Sacramento. The two of them hit it off immediately and started their infamous sex-driven murderous relationship. Motivated by depraved sexual fantasies, Gerald and Charlene were a husband and wife serial killer team, active from 1978 until 1980 in the western United States. Gerald dominated Charlene, told her what to wear, how to act, and forced her to turn over any money she made. She still found him exciting, even more when he talked about his fantasy to have what he called young, disposable sex slaves. The fantasy became a nightmare for 17-year-old Rhonda Scheffler and 16-year-old Kippy Vaught in 1978. Using their Dodge van, Gerald and Charlene drove to a shopping center where Charlene was charged with finding their slaves. She lured the girls into the van with promises of smoking pot. When they got there, all the teenagers found was Gerald and his pistol. After forcing the girls into the van, they drove to the Sierra Nevada mountains, where Gerald raped the girls. They were killed at different locations later that day. This scenario was played out again and again over the next few years. Charlene eventually began to involve herself with the rape of the girls that were abducted. In all, they killed at least 9 women, some as young as 13, with one being pregnant. They also killed one man, a boyfriend of a young girl they abducted. Craig Miller and Mary Elizabeth Sowers were their last victims. Craig was gunned down on the side of the road in 1980, and his girlfriend was abducted. This time, however, friends of the couple gave the license plate number of the vehicle to the police, which led to Gerald and Charlene's arrest. In 1984, Charlene testified against Gerald in exchange for not being tried in California. She pled guilty to murder and received a sentence of just over 16 years. Gerald was tried and convicted of murder in both California and Nevada. He was sentenced to death, but died in prison. Not all buddy male-female serial killers are motivated by perversion and sex, as was the case of Faye Copeland and her husband, Gray. Not much is known about Faye. It is reported she had six children and knew quite well about her husband's life of crime and psychopathic behavior. But then crime turned to killing for Faye and her husband. Convicted of killing five drifters and likely many more, Faye Della Wilson Copeland and Ray Copeland became, at the ages of 69 and 76 respectively, the oldest couple ever sentenced to death in the United States. The MO in these crimes varied little. Faye Copeland would invite transient, homeless, or migrant workers to their place, or they were promised an easy and lucrative job. Since the 1970s, the Copelands had been known to pick up hitchhikers to work on his farm. Uneasy neighbors watched year after year as a parade of the scrappy, unsavory, and unshaven came and went. No one ever knew what became of them, and no one cared. They weren't the kinds of characters who were likely to send postcards. It wasn't until late summer 1989, after the anonymous call to the Crime Stoppers hotline, that the residents of Mooresville had their worst suspicions confirmed. The victims had been shot with a .22 caliber rifle, the bodies disposed of on the farm. Ray even using neighboring farms to hide some of the bodies. Buddy serial killers share similar backgrounds and often begin their killing spree when they are young adults. Not so for Ray and Faye Copeland. Their lust for killing came in their retirement years. Why this elderly couple went from being loving grandparents to serial killers who use their victims' clothing to make a warm winter quilt to snuggle under, is both gruesome and disconcerting. The motives for the serial murders were apparently monetary. It was estimated that the Copelands received approximately $32,000 from reselling items from their victims. Like many serial killers, when arrested, Faye denied any knowledge of or involvement in the monstrous acts of murder. She told investigators, "I never done nothing." However, a jury refused to believe her, and Faye Copeland died in prison on December 30th, 2003. Another deadly male-female serial killer duo terrorized the citizens of California. Carol Bundy, a nurse and divorced mother of two, found her killing mate in Doug Clark, a boiler engineer for the Jergens Lotion Company. Together, they teamed up as Hollywood's Sunset Strip Killers. As crazed a duo of serial killers that ever stalked the streets of America's cities. Starting in the spring of 1980, Bundy and Clark went on a murderous rampage through the City of Angels. A rampage that would leave six dead. The first victims were discovered in June. Two women, both killed with the same signature. A gunshot to the head. A gun purchased by Carol Bundy. This was followed by the tragic murder of Exie Wilson. Her head, chopped from her body, was discovered days later in an ornate wooden box. Quickly, the bodies began to stack up, each killed by a bullet to the head. Five women in all, prostitutes and teenage runaways, women from the fringes of society, the easiest victims.
I think that the subject of the victims of these serial murders is probably something that is criminally under-discussed. These are living, breathing human people whose lives were stolen from them by these individuals. I think the fact that a lot of the victims of serial murderers were people from the fringes of society had a lot to do with not only their availability to the killer, but also to the lack of quick and decisive public response to their crimes. When prostitutes start to disappear from the street, prostitutes disappear all the time. You know, they come and go. It's a transitory thing. Bums, hobos, you know, the old-fashioned term, transients, homeless people, are easy targets for people who desire to commit these kinds of crimes, and the access to them is greater, the ability to get control of them is greater, and over time, depending on the killer's own pathology, the notion of them being missing is significantly lessened. You look at people, at serial killers who did not kill prostitutes or people on the fringes of society. Those cases got a lot of attention, and very quickly.
The case was finally solved when police nabbed Carol Bundy for the murder of Jack Murray, a one-time lover who she shot, stabbed, and beheaded in the back of his van. Confronted with the evidence of her guilt, Bundy implicated her partner, Clark. And Clark returned the favor. The lovers turned on each other like the animals they were.
I interviewed Carol Ann Bundy, Douglas Clark and Carol Ann Bundy, and Bundy was over here in Chowchilla Prison. And I happened to be over there visiting somebody else, and I saw her. Well, one of my colleagues saw her and said, "Hey, you want to go see her?" Okay, so we slipped in and went over to visit her. And it was such an interesting little interview with her. You know, you think she's a serial killer, she must be really dangerous. She looked like just a little lady that couldn't harm a flea. And she was not well, and she eventually died. She was diabetic and died. But that interview was, I asked her about, because this is Carol Ann Bundy had actually, to prove her loyalty to Douglas Clark, had actually killed her boyfriend, cut off his head, cut off his buttocks, to show her love, that she could do this for him. And you don't understand what Douglas Clark did. They would abduct women off the streets, and then they would cut off their heads, and then they would shampoo their hair and freeze the heads and put makeup on them and so on, and he'd have sex with the heads in the shower. So when I asked her about Douglas Clark, I said, "So did you ever keep in touch with Douglas?" And she goes, "Oh no, I'm not allowed to talk to him anymore." She says, "Doctor, don't you think that Douglas Clark is a very strange man?" Well, she's asking me this. I want to do a Jeff Foxworthy. Well, not only is he a strange man, but you're a strange woman. What you did was, even though you were his accomplice, I mean, you actually were part of all that. And she didn't kind of grasp that, but she was a follower. And in these dual relationships, when you have two people killing, one always dominates. There's always a leader.
10 years after the Sunset Strip killers perpetrated their evil deeds, Canada's buddy kinky sex killers, Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, started their vicious killing spree. Paul Bernardo was born on August 27, 1964. He was described as an adorable baby with bright blue eyes, thick, wavy blonde hair, and a cherubic smile. He was a Boy Scout and a good student. However, he ran away at the age of 5 or 6 and returned home several days later. No one ever asked him where he had been. He did not socialize with other children and was subject to violent temper tantrums. After high school, he attended the Scarborough branch of the University of Toronto. Carla Leanne Homolka was born on May 4, 1970. Her father was a Czech immigrant and salesman. Her mother worked at St. Catherine's Shaver Hospital. Though she had a consistently acrimonious relationship with her parents, she had an enjoyable childhood. She made friends easily and was a very good student. She did, however, have the disconcerting habit of yelling, "fuck," at inappropriate times. And during her teen years, angst led to self-mutilation. She intentionally slit her wrist with a small knife a couple of times. Bernardo and Homolka, just a couple of young Canadians ready to join paths in serial killing. It began when, at age 17, Homolka attended a pet convention in Toronto, where she met 23-year-old Paul Bernardo. They had sex the day they met. Besides an interest in pets, they found they shared something else: sadomasochistic fantasies. It started with rape, but quickly led to murder. Murders that took place between December 23, 1990 and April 16, 1992.
The crimes of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka were among the most disgusting of the serial killer cases. Paul Bernardo, before his serial murder career began, was known as a Scarborough rapist. He raped approximately 350 women over a series of years. When he and Carla got together, he was a macho man, and Carla was kind of unconfident. So for Christmas one year, Carla gave Paul her sister as a sex toy. They took her downstairs to the basement, and they gave her food laced with halcyon, and then they put a cloth saturated with ether over her face. Before Paul could rape her, though, she choked on her own vomit. And I think that level of deplorability is not common in all serial murder cases. Another thing they did that was especially terrible is when they caught a woman, they would kidnap her, take her home, rape her and torture her, and then make her watch TV coverage of the crimes. And I consider that to be a psychological, sadistic act that is not often found in serial murder cases. They turned on each other after the event, and Carla pled to a lesser crime, and her career testimony put Paul away. But I think when you look at all the things they did, they were just horrible, horrible people and unusually vicious serial killers.
Like other buddy serial killing teams, one is usually dominant.
It's believed that Paul was the leader, that he attracted Carla, Carla wanted him, and would do anything to get him. As in many cases, the exact victimage is unknown. The best guess is 4 or 5 victims.
On June 29, 1991, just 14 days after murdering Leslie Mahaffey, Bernardo and Homolka were married in an elaborate wedding at a church in Niagara-on-the-Lake, Ontario. The guests were served a lavish sit-down meal after the couple exchanged their vows, vows which included, at Bernardo's insistence, Homolka promising to love, honor, and obey her new husband. They looked like the perfect, loving couple, but they were anything but. Eventually, the Canadian media and public played a role in this deadly couple's capture.
Many of the times, if there aren't leads in a case, publicity will bring in enough tips that someone can be caught. That happened in the case of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, who were escaping with their crimes until the police broadcast a TV show about this, and then a couple witnesses realized what they knew, and the salients had their information to the crimes, and they called in.
Recognizing the writing was on the wall, Homolka confessed to their evil deeds. Bernardo was arrested shortly after. When law enforcement searched Bernardo's home, they found a diary where he had memorialized his evil deeds. Having struck a plea deal in 1993, Carla Homolka was released from prison 12 years later, on July 4, 2005. Paul Bernardo is serving a life sentence. Many claim their punishments were not nearly enough for the crimes carried out by this deadly couple. One of the major findings of the past 15 years regarding serial killing is serial murder respects no national boundaries, as the murderous Canadian couple demonstrated. So too, serial killing by couples respects no ethnic or racial boundaries. As is the case of the Black Bonnie and Clyde clearly showed. In 1984, Deborah Denise Brown and Alton Coleman went on a 53-day Midwest, six-state crime spree that resulted in 20 sexual assaults and 8 murders, including 3 children, plus 7-year-old Tamika Turks of Gary, Indiana, an innocent child who they strangled in Gary, Indiana's Glen Park for no apparent reason other than the joy of killing. These murders of undeserving victims earned this evil couple a spot on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. When Alton Coleman and Deborah Brown met in 1983, he was 28, a middle school dropout who was living with his 73-year-old grandmother in Waukegan, Illinois. He had already been leading a criminal life, being charged with numerous sex crimes and multiple robberies. Borderline mentally handicapped Brown was 21 and had been living a relatively quiet, crime-free life. Suddenly, she ended a marriage engagement, left her family, and joined Alton Coleman in what was described as a slave-master relationship. Why?
You got Deborah Brown and Alton Coleman. You know, it's... What's the attraction? Excitement? Adventure? Same mindset?
A mindset that sent them on a burglary, rape, and killing spree in Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, Indiana, Kentucky, and Ohio. Their MO was to briefly befriend African-American strangers, then assault them, sometimes raping and murdering each of them in turn. Their victims included children and elderly. Finally, on July 20th, 1984, in Evanston, Illinois, someone from Coleman's old neighborhood recognized the couple and called police. Shortly after they were arrested, the serial killing spree of this deadly couple was over. On April 26, 2002, reciting "The Lord is my shepherd," Alton Coleman died by lethal injection in the death chamber at the state prison in Lucasville, Ohio. Brown, having her death sentence commuted to life in prison, was unrepentant. At her trial, she sent a note to the judge which read in part, "I killed the bitch, and I don't give a damn. I had fun out of it." Again, confirming serial killers love the act of killing another human. Two other African Americans, this time two men, teamed up for serial murder. Two men with a sniper rifle turned Washington, D.C. into their own gruesome human shooting gallery. They became known as the Beltway Snipers. They formed the classic older man and younger man serial killing team. Born John Allen Williams, Muhammad had joined the Black Nation of Islam, and in October 2001, at the age of 40, changed his name to John Allen Muhammad. Muhammad found Malvo at a homeless shelter and took the young teen to his house. He had lost his own children in a custody battle and now had a surrogate son, someone he could father, someone he could mentor. Only this mentoring was about depraved indifference to human life. In fact, it was their great distance from their victims that would add a new twist to the usual serial murder team.
The Beltway killings were completely different, whether you want to believe they're politically motivated, whether they're religiously motivated, and they had planned to start targeting people and just start killing them. And it wasn't for the personal contact or the personal control over somebody like you see with so many of these people. It was reaching out from a distance, reaching out literally and touching someone where they were shooting them from a distance and killing them. They don't even see their work close up. So that's a little bit different breed of animal.
Muhammad and Malvo's trek of death began in Tacoma, Washington, where, according to the Seattle Times newspaper, they practiced their sniper skills on the firing range of a gun store known as Bullseye Shooter Supply. Their first kill came in Montgomery, Alabama, when Claudine Parker was shot in a liquor store holdup. Their serial killing began in earnest on October 2nd, when, in the span of 20 hours, Muhammad and Malvo shot six people in Montgomery County, Maryland. All were killed with what would become the Beltway Snipers' trademark MO and signature, lying in wait and killing their victims at a distance with a single round from a Bushmaster XM-15, the perfect sniper rifle.
What I think is interesting, again, with the Beltway Snipers, and it was in the area around Washington, again, you have a pair of individuals, one person more dominant than the other, you have a desire for a kind of anonymous crime. The victims and the killers were not only were they not connected in any, you know, specific way that they knew each other, but they were disconnected by a great deal of physical space. By killing them from a distance, you not only removed a lot of the danger of apprehension, but you also removed any close, up close and personal connection to the victim.
Muhammad and Malvo were cowards who staked out places where people shopped, gas stations, convenience stores, on streets where they walked. The only purpose was to terrorize, create a panic. Their tactic worked. Fear shot through the communities of Montgomery County and throughout the nation's capital. Schools went into lockdown. Muhammad and Malvo widened their range, and the real plan behind their killings began to unfold. On October 7th, after Iran Brown, a 13-year-old schoolboy, was wounded as he arrived at school, police found a tarot card with a note. Dear policeman, I am God. Over the next 15 days, with another five people shot and killed, their plan became clear in long, rambling messages to the police. A ransom demand of $10 million to free the nation's capital from the terror of the Beltway Snipers.
The Beltway Snipers began with a profit motive. They had decided to extort $10 million from the authorities. First, they killed five people at random in the D.C. area in October 2002. And then they intended to stop and negotiate with Chief Moose for the money. So Malvo, the younger of the two killers, called the tip hotline. Unfortunately, the operator had received 70,000 tips, unmanageable, unable to place in any priority level because of the vast number, and so hung up four times on Malvo, who got very frustrated by his inability to get through, and instead killed more people. Rather than attempting to make money, they instead liked becoming celebrities. They enjoyed playing a cat and mouse game with the police and taunting them in some of their messages. I am God, meaning you'll never catch me. I'm superior to you.
But they weren't gods, and their tirade of terror would not last much longer. The police now knew the make and model of the car, a blue Chevy Caprice. On October 24th, they found John Allen Muhammad and Lee Boyd Malvo sleeping in their car. At last, the nightmare was over. At trial, prosecutors introduced exhibits showing that Muhammad and Malvo planned to emulate the Islamic jihadists and terrorists of 9/11. One was a portrait of Saddam Hussein labeled as a protector. Another was a father and son portrait of Malvo and Muhammad with the words, "We will kill them all, jihad." Muhammad was executed by lethal injection in Jarrett, Virginia on November 10, 2009. John Lee Malvo is serving a life imprisonment without parole. Henry Lee Lucas and Otis Toole claimed they were the most prolific, sadistic pair of serial killers that ever walked the earth. And they may have been right.
Henry Lee Lucas is a good example of someone who wanted to be the Heisman Trophy winner of serial murder, claiming to have amassed a huge body count. At one time, he said that he had killed 800 people. Another time, he said it was 360.
Henry Lee Lucas was born in Blacksburg, Virginia in 1936. Raised by a sadistic and abusive mother, Henry, like a number of other serial killers, engaged in animal torture. He killed them and then sexually violated their corpses, a practice he carried into his murderous crime spree many years later. At the age of 14, Lucas claims to have killed his first victim.
If you believe his story of killing a young girl who was waiting for a school bus, and he was riding around as a, I think he was 14 or 15 years of age, and gotten hold of a car and took this young kid up on the side of a hill and raped her, and then decided he didn't want any witnesses, so he killed her. And he told me that had swatted a fly.
Following a series of petty crimes and prison terms, Lucas got into a fight with his 74-year-old mother. After stabbing her to death, he had sex with her corpse. That was in 1960. 10 years later, he was released from prison at the age of 34. He went back to prison immediately, this time for trying to kidnap two teenage girls. He was released for the final time in 1975.
Henry Lee Lucas was let out of jail in Jackson, Michigan. He told the prison officials that he was going to leave them on their doorstep if they let him go. There are two confirmed deaths attributed to Lucas in Michigan after he was released, his final release from Jackson Prison in Jackson, Michigan, which most people believe were committed by Lucas.
Soon after, Lucas met Otis Toole, a vicious homosexual psychopath. Together, they unleashed an 8-year reign of terror, roaming the country, killing and mutilating untold numbers of victims. Lucas claimed he picked up most of his prey along the interstates, offering rides and sometimes dinner or a drink. "Just about everyone I pick up, I kill 'em," That's the way it always turns out. To me, a live woman ain't nothing. I enjoy dead sex more than I do live sex. Steve Egger is a criminologist and former police officer who had direct contact with Lucas, interviewing him many times.
Lucas confessed to a lot. Lucas confessed crimes he didn't commit. Lucas would confess to crimes when the officers or the investigators would use profanity. Lucas would confess to a person if he didn't like them. But the real key was don't use any cuss words. Don't use damn, don't use darn, don't use anything. And that's the best advice I got from a gentleman who was with 2020, a producer who had interviewed Lucas and told me when I went down and I was scheduled to go down and see Lucas to not use any, you know, swear words at all. And I didn't. And, you know, look him straight in the eye and shake his hand, and we went from there. So we had a relationship for a while in which I would interview him in his cell. I would interview him downstairs where he would come down for coffee and chain smoking Pall Mall cigarettes before he was scheduled for his interviews in the morning. I would drive over from Huntsville, Sam Houston State University, where I was a doctoral student, and get up real early and drive over there when it was still dark over the rural roads of Texas, which was fun. And we'd talk. And other times I rode with him when he escorted the Texas Rangers and other Texas law enforcement agents to the scene of his crimes in Texas, the individuals he'd killed, and in some cases the bodies that had not been found. Personally, I think Lucas probably killed, between Lucas and Toole, Toole worked with him for a while, who was a flaming transvestite arsonist, if you will. Between the two of them, they probably killed 50 to 60 people, which in my ball, you know, in my world, that's a lot of people. He claimed first to have killed 60 when he first started confessing after he'd been arrested for a violation of parole and having a weapon. Then he confessed to killing Kate Rich, which was really his last victim, an older woman that he killed and stuffed under a house and later took her back out of the house and burned her in a pot-belly stove. And that was confirmed. And his girlfriend, lover, daughter, if you will, which he treated different ways depending on his mood, according to him, he killed her and dropped parts of her around a field. That was his second to last killing, I believe. Or it may be vice versa, I'm not sure, because it was hard to get the sequence right. But I believe he killed 50 to 60 people.
Then, in 1983, Lucas was picked up on a weapons charge in Texas. While coming out of the DTs, he claimed to have a religious experience and began confessing to countless murders in order to receive redemption from his maker. After a brief trial, Lucas was put on death row. For many, Lucas was the most unusual serial killer of all time. The perfect serial killer. He partnered with a gay sociopath, roamed the country looking for victims, mutilating them, cannibalizing them, and practicing necrophilia on them. For others, Lucas is the ultimate manipulator and liar. As for Toole, in April 1984, he was convicted for killing 64-year-old George Sonnenberg in Florida. Later that year, Toole was found guilty of the 1983 slaying of 19-year-old Ada Johnson and received a second death sentence. However, both sentences were commuted to life in prison. Were the bizarre claims by Lucas and Toole works of fantasy or reality? What we know for sure is that both men died of cirrhosis of the liver in prison, Toole in 1996 and Lucas in 2001. Ironically, 3 years before Lucas died, on June 26, 1998, then Texas Governor George Bush commuted his death sentence to life imprisonment. Lucas is the only death row inmate to ever receive clemency from the 43rd President of the United States. It is estimated that around 20% of all serial killing is done by pairs, and although each case is unique, there are some common threads. Like Ted Bundy, John Wayne Gacy, and the Green River Killer, to name just a few, there is often a sexual component in addition to the killing. In a number of cases, there are special places where the torture and murder take place. H.H. Holmes' murder castle, Charles Ng and Leonard Lake's torture bunker, and BTK Dennis Rader fantasized a murder barn. Fantasizing about the killing is perhaps the most common thread. One serial killing team that checked all these boxes were Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker, the notorious toolbox killers. Roy Norris and Lawrence Bittaker met in 1977 while serving time in prison. Norris had been convicted of rape and Bittaker of attempted murder. There they shared fantasies of sexual violence, fantasies of murdering one girl of each teenage year from 13 to 19. Out of prison, they teamed up and built their unique murder castle.
There is one that's usually the leader, more dominant personality, yeah. And there's one that's obviously a follower. Bittaker and Norris in California, they had a van called Murder Mac, and it was fixed to be a vehicle to commit murder in. And they would tape the screams of their victims and then play it back. Bittaker was the main man, and Norris was kind of the follower, yeah.
On June 24th, 1979, their first victim was 16-year-old Lucinda Lynn Schaefer. Both men raped Schaefer in the back of the van before strangling her with a wire coat hanger and vice grip pliers. 2 weeks later, the men encountered Andrea Joy Hall, 18, hitchhiking on the Pacific Coast Highway. They sexually tortured Hall and made her pose for Polaroids before driving an ice pick through her head, strangling her, and finally throwing her over a cliff. They became known as the toolbox killers because they used common household tools, including pliers, coat hanger wires, and sledgehammers, tools used to brutally torture their victims. Three more deaths followed before they were caught 5 months after it all began. Bittaker was put on death row, and Norris was given a life sentence. One thing that is clear today is that, with the internet, potential serial killers will find it much easier to find a partner to share their sick fantasies and team up for serial murder.